Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. Dr. Hugh Berryman of the Sociology and Anthropology Department here at MTSU is holding his third annual CSI MTSU Camp in June, and he is here to tell us all about it once again, and it's an opportunity for young people to find out what forensic investigations are really all about. They get to see what they can do with crime scenes, and but there's a lot more to it than what you see on television on any of the three CSI shows. And hooray for Hollywood, but this ain't it. Okay? Is that fair, Hugh?
That's very fair.
Okay.
Yes.
Hugh Berryman, thanks for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
What are the dates for the camp, first of all?
June 16th through 19th.
Okay. And what age range of youngsters are you looking at for attending the camp?
Grades 10 through 12.
Okay.
Attend, and this is the third year that we've put this on, and it's been a tremendous success. The kids seem to really enjoy doing this. It's a challenge for them, and again, one of the reasons for doing this, and even I remember my high school days. Sometimes you take some courses and you wonder what is the application of this? Something in science or something in math, and how would you ever use that? Well, what we try to do with these workshops is to give the student a chance to work crime scenes, and since it's forensics, it's CSI type stuff, it helps to stimulate the student's interest in math and science, and also to improve their critical thinking skills, which is really needs to be improved sometime. But they've been very successful, and the students have really enjoyed them.
You have to go really outside the box if you're going to investigate a crime scene, don't you? Because you can't go in there with a bunch of suppositions and prejudices and beliefs that such and such is the case all of the time. You have to leave your mind open to the possibility of the not-so-obvious, right?
Absolutely, you do. And what we do, we set up artificial crime scenes, and they're very realistic. I'm a forensic anthropologist, and I've worked real crime scenes for since 1980. Well, prior to that, as a student working with Dr. Bass at University of Tennessee at Knoxville, he would take the students out on crime scenes. And in fact, here at MTSU, I have a group of students that. They're trained in archaeological technique and osteology, recognizing bones. They know some of the basics in forensics and evidence and how to handle evidence. And we work skeletal crime scenes in the Middle Tennessee area. It's called the Phaser Team, Forensic Anthropology Search and Recovery Team. And so, in fact, these students sometimes will assist in the CSI course in helping us with that. But the crime scenes that we put together are. They reflect reality, and I try to make them as realistic as I possibly can as far as what the students are going to have to look, what they're going to look at, and what they're going to have to do in order to solve the crime, or to identify who did this, and to be able to get the type of evidence that would hold up in court as to who did it. Math, science, critical thinking, big parts of that, and you can't go into a crime scene with preconceived ideas. In fact, when we put these scenarios together, we like to give several choices, red herrings, if you will, where a student may go along one line and this seems like the proper line, and then all of a sudden they begin to realize there's just nothing here, and they have to retrace their steps. Who do I interrogate, or who do I investigate, who do I need to talk to next? The way these courses are set up, we start out with a 911 call. And that's it. We give that to the student. The students are divided into teams, and they compete with each other as who can solve this, first. And they get this 911 call, and that's all they have. And the idea is, if you don't ask, you don't get. So there's information in there. It may be a name of a friend that was mentioned, or some little piece of information in there, and they will come and ask us. did you interview so-and-so? And if we did, they have, each group has a thumb drive, and they'll give it to us, and we'll put that interview, that it's written out, what was said in that interview. When they get that, there may be another name mentioned there, or two or three names and other leads. And ultimately, it goes from interviews to maybe interrogations of suspects to lab reports. And they actually go to crime scenes. It's a lot of fun.
Do they actually get to interview real people who are pretending to be, you know, the nosy neighbor, the innocent bystander, the dude who homeless dude who hangs out on the corner?
Well, you know, we thought about doing that, and I would love to eventually do something like that. But right now, it has to be a document that's electronic that we can just transfer to a thumb drive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's not just that the student is getting more than just the math, the science, an application for critical thinking that maybe they haven't really experienced at that level before. It's not only that, but the other part, they have it's a time that they learn to work in a team, because it is a team effort. And it's a time that we have little short courses through that on fingerprints, hair analysis, fibers, blood spatter analysis, ballistics, footprint, tire print, and lots of different DNA, lots of different areas of evidence that they get to take these little mini courses, because they're going to apply what they learned from that to these crime scenes that they're introduced to. And on the last day of this workshop, they get another experience. They have to present their findings through the use of a PowerPoint. So they have to develop their own PowerPoints on how they investigated this case, who they think did it, and what evidence that they were able to find. And they are up front, present this on Friday afternoon, the end of the workshop. They present this to the other participants, and their parents are invited, and we've had success. Parents come down, and they listen to all the presentations, and it's just, they get a lot of different experience other than just going to a crime scene. So it's, and another thing I might add, we try to put a theme to these. The first was drugs and problems you can get into in drugs. And next was the one we did last year. It had to do with computers and on MySpace, for example, getting a little too much personal information on computers and what kind of problems that can cause. And we got into electronic evidence last year, digital evidence, and how to handle that and what various forms it comes in. And this year, the theme will be gangs and some of the problems in, some things they need to consider relative to gangs. And it kind of comes out as we work through this particular crime.
And all of these themes are quite obviously youth-oriented. It's right up their alley. It's not something germane specifically to the adult world that they can't understand or can't relate to.
No, it is. We try to make it specific to them, and that's my greatest challenge, is to try to, that's a culture that I moved out of a few years ago. So I need subtitles probably sometime when I talk to them, but we do try to direct that to them. And in scenarios that they can identify with.
What do you use, the real materials, or do you have to use fake materials that simulate things like blood? And because, well, you know, anytime you're dealing with bodily fluids, there's a biohazard concern.
And we use other materials. I have a friend who does works with in the movie industry, and there's different, if you will, recipes for fake blood that'll have some of the same consistency of blood. For example,
some people used to use chocolate, didn't they?
Well, that would approach that. Yeah. The interesting thing about it gets into physics, because a drop of liquid in flight will form a sphere. It'll have surface tension on it. And then how it reacts when it hits the surface. And if you've ever noticed, for just one little brief thing that the students get into, as a drop hits the surface, it'll first be a round blotch, and then in the direction it's traveling, it will just dissipate until it's a nice point. So each one of those droplets points in the direction it was traveling when it hit a surface. Mm-hmm. So they can put all this together and figure out where someone was in the room or where the source of the blood, where it came from.
So you have to get a liquid that will mimic the way blood would react.
Right. And it's not going to be blood because we're not going to, we have to have those considerations of safety and everything. But we do work with materials that will either mimic what we need, and some of them casting materials. We may have dental records that they have to match up to identify someone. So that it's, again, I try to make this as accurate as I possibly can. And one interesting thing I noticed it the first time we actually had one of these schools. We were in an apartment, and we had a bullet hole or one or two bullet holes in the wall, and chairs turned over, and blood spatter, and a white powder substance on a counter and on the floor, so they get into chemistry. And we would take these different groups in one at a time, and they get to investigate the room and take photographs and make notes on whatever they want to be asking about later. Because at some point, they may say, that white powder that was on the cabinet, is there a lab report on that? And if there is, I send that to the group, and they have to fit that piece of information into solving this. But I was in the room when one of the groups came in, and they began to discuss what was going on, and you get these little arguments break out. And it just hit me. This is like crime scenes I've been to where law enforcement would be doing the investigators would be in and say, no, you've got it wrong. Look at this. So you get these little, the kids were doing exactly the same thing adult investigators do when they go out to crime scenes. It was just neat.
Do the criminalists resent when the police detectives try to play criminalist and say, well, I think that's such and such, and the criminalist is like, no, wait a minute, I'm the science person here.
Well, everyone, I think, guards their own turf to some extent. But, and sometimes you have to be careful doing even that because everyone's capable of critical thinking and analyzing a situation, and some people are naturally very good at it. So I'm not so sure, even when I go out and work scenes involving skeletal remains, that if someone says something, I'm going to think about what they're saying because they may see something I'm not seeing. And, I'm not consider something that somebody says. Some you can very rapidly mm-hmm. know that has nothing to do with it, but others you might need to think about a little bit before you not go there or something.
Yeah, in the real world, science aside, it's a given that the science is important. But to what extent does gut instinct and experience play a role in being able to ferret out the truth?
Well, I think that does play a role. I think it plays a very real role, and I think you have people who just have innate abilities. Some better than others at investigating a scene and at, again, examining and taking in what they see and weighting different things that they see differently, what's important, what's not important in this case. Someone who's not easily biased. One of the problems you have if you walk into a crime scene and you get some idea hit you early on, you have to be very, very careful to leave your mind open for other possibilities because If it's so powerful, this one idea, if you may look at the scene and say, this is a suicide, there's so many things so many pieces of evidence you'll look at, and you just won't see them. You won't see what's right in front of you because it doesn't fit what's in your mind, and you eliminate it mentally.
I know of a case where it looked like it was a suicide. This was years and years ago in Alabama, but actually the body had been killed before it was strung up.
Oh, yeah.
From the neck. And so time of death plays a role in determining whether it's a suicide or a homicide.
We had one a case that I remember from my past of an individual who was found at home sitting in a chair, shot, handgun underneath his hand as though it had fallen out on the floor, suicide note on the table. And it looked like a suicide. And it was basically, the scene looked like a suicide. That's the first impression when you walk in. It's a suicide, and you got a suicide note. However, the blood, we had a great blood spatter person mm-hmm. just walking through the room, looked at that and said, that's not a suicide. And what she picked up on immediately was the blood on the individual's shirt was running in two directions. It ran vertically, and then it ran horizontally, which means he was shot. He was on the floor, laying on his side, bleeding. Someone picked him up, set him in the chair, and then gravity forced the blood down the other way. So there was two blood patterns that you couldn't reconcile with a suicide. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's what I'm talking about. Some people, and that was her area, was blood spatter, but just at a glance, I mean, she picked up on something that had not been picked up until that point.
Even though most of us don't know the specific techniques and the specific clues to look for, the crime scene investigation has been so thoroughly dramatized in the popular culture by now, wouldn't you think that even the dumbest criminal who has watched TV only once would pick up on the fact that science is going to find you out? You might not know how, but they'll get to you eventually.
Well, don't underestimate how dumb some criminals can be, because it is pretty amazing sometimes. And you have to realize sometimes people get themselves in situations, and then when, you know, when a criminal gets in trouble, the realization that he's in trouble doesn't come up on him gradually. It tends to hit him all at once, and so he may react in ways that he just does not think through. He just does something, and it's usually the wrong something. Mm-hmm. And it's with science today and with people who investigate scenes and know what they're doing, it's very, very difficult for a criminal to make sure he's covered all of his tracks.
If he's that dumb to commit the crime to begin with, he's not going to outsmart a scientist.
There's one exception to that the scariest of all, the organized serial killers. Hannibal Lecter was a composite of a number of serial killers. And he's portrayed as having an incredibly high IQ. Organized serial killers tend to have, I mean, there's some with 160 IQ, that some of them may actually take crime scene kits. And when they do the crime, they may process their own crime scene, because they know everything that we know. They know everything the investigators know. They've read the things that we write, and so they're a challenge. And that's why I think I found the movie Hannibal Lecter to be really one of the scariest movies I've ever seen, because this guy represented what's possible out there with some people.
But even Hannibal Lecter got caught. He escaped, but he got caught.
Yes, he did.
Talk about the experiential learning aspect of this camp for a minute. There are all kinds of camps during the summer that have an academic bent. There are camps for writers. There are camps for language learning. There are camps that are sort of extenuated versions of what you get in school with a fun summertime twist. And there are even math and science camps. But I don't know of any other camp that gives you something. Most of the camps give you something you can get in high school. CSI, MTSU, gives you math and science in the camp, and it's fun, but you don't usually see in a high school science setting an emphasis on crime scene investigation, do you? I mean, I don't know of any high school that takes that angle.
I don't think so. There are the health science people in the state of Tennessee are using forensics now in high school classrooms to stimulate interest, and I'm working with that group some. But there is that attempt out there. And before I came here to MTSU in 2007, I worked with groups, and we had courses in New Orleans, and had one course in Nashville, in fact, that was it was forensic. All the people that taught the course were forensic people, had worked doing actual forensic cases, and we directed the course for high school teachers. And what they were doing is they were trying to get into forensics to the point that they could present realistic scenarios to their kids. Because I think it is a fun way to do something, because you have a problem you're trying to solve. And many times the students are either competing with other students in class or with groups like we're doing it with our workshops. And it's a challenge. And there's just a drive to find out that next piece of information you need, and that may be the one you've been looking for that'll lock this thing up. And it's just, I mean, the students have a lot of fun with this. And we've had, we were doing this over 3 days, and we asked for critical comments from all the students that took it last year, and we really got no critical comments, but we did have a number of students that asked that it be 4 days instead of, well, they wanted 5 days, but we compromised, we're doing this one 4 days instead of three. So we've added a day to it, and I can't give it away because who knows who may be listening, but this is going to be there's going to be some new experiences here because we have some students that come back. We have, I think, six students this time that this will be the third time for them to take this, and they really enjoy what they're doing. And they're going to get some new experiences this time that not only are they getting, but I'll put it this way, they're not a lot of law enforcement and other people that are getting some of the experiences that have had the experiences that they'll have after this one.
Some special surprises.
There's going to be some surprises on this one, yes.
I don't know that it's even feasible in these tight times, but wouldn't you love to see something like this integrated into the high school curricula, into the bureaucracy at the high school level? I mean, you could design a course that was geared for high school youngsters that lasted the entire academic year on a high school level, could you not?
I think you probably could. And the thing about this, it has the potential of touching on so many different areas in science and math. You can actually get into the courts. I've had scenarios and situations where you can have a piece of evidence, and anytime a piece of evidence is taken from a crime scene, every time it changes hands, there has to be people who sign a piece of paper saying what that evidence is, signing to receive it, and signing to release it.
Absolutely.
It's called a chain of evidence or chain of custody, and both means the same. That's a link, a paper link, every time evidence changes hands. If someone forgets to sign that somewhere along the way, no matter how important that evidence is, it can be kicked out. When it gets to the courts, it may not be acceptable, can't be used. And so you can have cases that could be just absolutely sewed up by one piece of evidence, but because someone along the way forgot to sign their name, can't use it. So that's the sort of thing that could be introduced into the classroom just to show you reality. I did a course when I was in Memphis at University of Memphis in the forensic anthropology department, or the anthropology department, and we had a forensic scene set up. I had cases where they excavate, and at the end of the day, I was so proud of one of the students because I asked them all to hand the stuff in so I could take it into the lab. I wasn't even thinking about chain of evidence at that time. It was the end of the day. It had been a long day. I had one student who refused to give me the stuff he had until I signed a release. And I thought, this kid got it. Of all of them out here, he got it.
You got to dot your I's and cross your T's, as do the police, because there are constitutional rights that have to be respected, and there are laws and regulations that have to be adhered to, right? And
you
have to be able to assure the judicial system that all of the evidence was handled properly and has not been tainted or manipulated in any way to bring about a particular judicial outcome.
Right. And when you sign one of those things, and I've signed many of them in the past, but what you're signing is a piece of paper that says you're taking that into your custody, and so when you get to court, you have to be able to witness to the court that has been secured, that it's not been, that no one else has been able to manipulate that. It's you basically guard that, and you're ensuring that it's going to be unchanged, or any change that you might do to it, you can document and pass that on to the next lab or to the courts or whatever.
In that vein, unfortunately, before CSI, I think most people's first introduction to blood splatter techniques,
spatter,
thank you, techniques, and crime scene investigation was the O.J. trial, because it was live and on TV, and because it was a key contention of the defense that the chain of custody had been tampered with or violated or infringed upon, and that the evidence was tainted. Please explain to people that when it, you can believe that that did happen or didn't happen, but in that particular case, but please explain to people that that is an aberration and that that's not the way our court system really works, and it's not the way most criminalists really are.
Well, it's as far as how the courts, that particular trial, well, I can't get into a lot of the specifics on the trial. One thing I can say about the trial that it did is after that trial, it tightened up all across the country. Crime scenes really began to tighten up what they did, and rightly so, because you can't take two pieces of evidence, put it in the same bag, transfer it to a lab, and then take them out and work on them. Because, you know, if you have a shirt from one person and a shirt from another person, it's in the same bag, there's going to be the possibility of a transfer of evidence between the two. What's on hair and fibers on one shirt may get transferred to the other one. And
dandruff, anything.
All sorts of things. And so you have, just because, you know, even shell casings, you have semi-automatic weapons that may, you know, you may have 15, 16 shell casings on the ground. Each one goes in a separate box. You don't put them all in one bag and take them back to the lab. Each one is separate, because when you get into the courtroom, if you find evidence on one of these objects, whatever it might be, you don't want the other side to be able to say, well, you know, how do I know it didn't come from that shirt that was in the bag with it, which belonged to someone else, not my client? So you have to make sure when you find something, it's specific to that one article. So the O.J. Simpson trial, the one thing that very positive that came out of that trial is that it, and rightly so, tightened up a lot of the procedures at crime scenes across the country.
Have any of the youngsters who've attended any of your camps indicated to you that they wanted to make this their career?
Well, yes, and that's one thing about this, I think. Not only do the students get to look at the science and see what it's about, but they get to imagine themselves doing this for a living. And some of them who are interested in chemistry or in biology or physics or some other aspect, it just represents, you know, a window into something that might be possible for them. And I think that alone is good for the students. So they do get to kind of investigate this as a possibility.
If people want to know more about the camp, who do they contact? Where do they go?
Well, this is through the Friends Against Youth for Research and Education.
Or FIRE
here at MTSU. And the easiest way I can give a web address, but probably the easiest way to remember it, if you just Google MTSU, FIRE, it'll go right to the website and pop up.
You mean comma?
Not on a web address. I'm just talking about going
to Google. Oh, Google. Oh, just Google.
Just Google MTSU FIRE.
And it'll go
right to it. So that's probably about the easiest way to remember it instead of giving a web address.
Especially on the radio.
Yeah.
And Hugh Berryman's email address at MTSU is Berryman, Berryman, at mtsu.edu if you want to drop him a line.
And I might want to mention, too, this year's workshop has filled up totally. Mm-hmm. We have two who are waiting on the sides in case students drop out. And we didn't advertise. Basically, it was word of mouth, and it was filled before we usually even start advertising.
So if you want to get in on next year's camp, now's the time to start planning.
Start early, yes.
Yeah. Dr. Hugh Berryman, thank you.
You're very welcome.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at this same time next Sunday. You can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com. And don't forget, we're also available on iTunes.